Podcasts by Demos.
This is a joint Demos and Prospect Magazine podcast in which Tom Chatfield interviews Evgeny Morozov, a leading thinker and commentator on the political implications of the internet.
Evgeny, if you could start off just by introducing yourself and saying a little about where you work and mm-hmm. what your interests are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm Evgeny Morozov. I'm a Yahoo Fellow at Georgetown University currently, which means I'm spending a lot of time thinking about how the internet and new media are reshaping the world of politics, not so much in the Western world, but mostly in authoritarian countries. So I also blog about it for Foreign Policy, and I'm currently working on a book which will tackle some of these issues in depth.
And I know you were recently writing for Prospect Magazine about, I suppose, the counterintuitive view, really, that we're also going to be talking about at Demos later this evening, that contrary to what a lot of people believe, the internet can be actually damaging towards democracy and can play into the hands of dictators and those who wish to restrict freedoms, rather than those who wish to campaign on behalf mm-hmm. of greater freedoms. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could tell me how you arrived at that counterintuitive position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the key word here is actually democratization rather than democracy. So the mainstream thinking on this issue is that somehow the activists will use the secure technologies provided by the internet and social networking. They will organize groups, and collectively they will then oppose and challenge the regime, which itself is perceived as somewhat of a laggard. So the common misperception about authoritarian states is that their governments are usually very bad at technology and all they do is just censor and filter. However, in my work and in my research, I noticed that, first of all, the kind of social mobilization that we often expect of activists is actually very insecure and it's not guaranteed. So often by joining groups on Facebook, they actually pose a lot of risks to their own security because this data is open and the authorities are actually watching what kind of new issues are emerging, what kind of campaigns are being organized, and there are a lot of dangers which are not fully understood yet. On the other hand, authoritarian governments are actually proving to be much more capable of exploiting technology for their own purposes. So we are seeing more and more ways in which they either use new media for propaganda by hiring bloggers, by paying people to hijack random online discussions and leave comments on a few articles, or by censorship, of course, always plays a big role. But, you know, one particular aspect which I find very disturbing is, again, surveillance. It's identifying activists and identifying who may be the next big dissidents. You know, you can actually have a very strong predictive model looking at who that particular person associates with online and what kind of words they use in their blogs, and then predict if they actually may pose a threat to the state in the future.
And could you tell me a little bit about, I suppose, your particular story and how mm-hmm. you arrived at this position? Because as I understand it, it's not a position that you've always held. It's something you came to believe mm-hmm. through experience.
Yes, well, I was actually working as a practitioner in this field. So I was working in a relatively well-known NGO called Transitions Online, which was doing a lot of new media development work in the former Soviet Union and a lot of countries in the Central Eastern Europe. And my job was actually try to think how to teach activists and bloggers and journalists how to use new media and to push for more freedoms. And what I started noticing is that no matter how much training we were offering to these guys, and no matter how many creative websites we were setting up with Western funding, the situation wasn't really changing for the better. Often it was actually changing for the worse. So that actually prompted me to start looking into how authoritarian governments themselves can benefit from it, either by putting activists at risk or by, you know, using it for propaganda or exerting psychological pressure through cyber attacks or a host of other reasons and ways in which they actually exploit cyberspace. So I kind of shifted more from the naive practitioner to cynical academic, I would say.
For a lot of people, if people were looking for a successful example, as is widely seen, of activism through social networks and the internet, people have been talking a lot about Iran and the use of Twitter in organizing protests after the elections. But is it the case that that was not, in fact, the triumphant story that a lot of people have said, that there was you know, a sort of another side to what appeared to be the facilitation of mass protests through social media?
Yes, well, I think the key word here is facilitation. And facilitation can take different forms. Facilitation could mean that the protests were actually publicized, discussed, and organized via Twitter. Or it could mean that the coverage of the protests and links to, you know, blogs and photos posted from the protests were exchanged on Twitter. And I think what happened in the case of Iran was actually the latter rather than the former. We actually saw very little actual planning being done on Twitter, because as a public platform, it's not very suitable for planning the next revolution. Because the last thing you want is to do it in the public space, because that will tip off the authorities, right? So I think we have to be very careful. I do concede that there was a lot of information exchange going on Twitter after the, you know, protest started. Some of it was not facilitated by Iranians in Iran. Some of it was facilitated by Iranians abroad, by the diaspora. And that was actually probably much bigger in scale than what was happening domestically. Again, this doesn't mean that the Iranians didn't use other tools in order to plan and in order to, you know, publicize the campaigns and the protests. But I think we tend to lump all of this very different and complex activities together and think that if it was not for Twitter, the protest would have never happened. And I just think that this is a very naive view, simply because, you know, even the Iranian Revolution of 1979, they still managed to plan it somehow without being online, right? So those revolutions happen often irrespectively of what happens to technology, and we tend to find causality where none exists.
And throughout this, when we're talking about the kind of spoiling tactics that people would use or purchase, what we're not talking about here is the sort of classic examples of government interference online, like the great firewall of China, this idea of a sort of monolithic state restrictions. And does this mean that what we're talking about in terms of the tactics used by dictators and spoilers doesn't look like the old-fashioned idea of just trying to shut people down or restrict information?
Yes, I think we actually are talking about some kind of an evolution of authoritarianism, where authoritarian governments actually learn to live in an environment where all the information is available, you know, and that still doesn't topple the governments in question, which is radically different from what we had, you know, in the 80s with, you know, USSR, or, you know, with China before the internet. I think the key thing to understand here is, again, that because of self-publishing, censorship becomes not a very appealing and cost-effective option for the governments. Because the more you try to censor someone or something, the more emboldened people become to actually repost this information elsewhere. You know, the so-called Streisand effect, which there has been a lot of talk of even in this country because, you know, of the injunctions and, you know, and what then it triggered on Twitter. And I think that's equally true in China, and that's probably even more true in China, where bloggers really feel very, passionate about trying to defy censorship. So what the governments start to do is, turn to what I call, you know, the spinternet, to try to hire paid commentators who can then spin and twist the original meaning and the original criticism that you intended was a blog post, to discredit you as a CIA agent, or to dispatch 100 people to make your position look ridiculous and as if it was somewhere on the fringe.
And away from, I suppose, what we think of as this division between the East and West and them and us, and, you know, the sort of the dictatorships and the goodies. Mm-hmm. I mean, are we going to see these kind of tactics infiltrating or being used in, in Western politics. And we have an election coming up in Britain. Mm-hmm. I mean, what role is the internet and this kind of underhand internet tactic going to play in elections like the British election?
Yes. Actually, now I've been reading a lot of reports recently on the knowledge transfer happening in the other direction, with the Chinese communist leaders coming to Britain to learn the lessons of spin from the labor politicians, right? And then come back and implement them at home. I think even if you look at the idea of the spinternet, much of it is rooted in the practice of astroturfing, which again was developed here in the West by, you know, Western corporations who wanted to get better profile in the media. So I think if anything, the knowledge transfer will be from here to authoritarian states rather than vice versa. The only, the only bad tools, I think, on influence that we'll see coming in that direction would probably be things like cyber attacks, where all the idle capacity actually is mostly concentrated in those countries, and all the tricks and all the cyber gangs are operating there.
So if you were making predictions for the next year or so, is there anything you could lay your hand on and say, you know, this is a trend I really expect to see happening in terms of political patterns of engagement online?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an extremely good question. Well, I think we'll be seeing more and more threats to freedom of expression online. More and more of those threats will be indirect, and more of them will be in forms which we do not anticipate, whether it's, again, the rising prominence of cyber attacks, or whether it's intimidating bloggers physically as opposed to just sending them. I think this is definitely one area to watch. I don't really know what will happen with propaganda. I assume that more and more traditional PR firms, both in authoritarian states and here, will move into that area, and there will be more of a professionalization of that space, as opposed to now the government's talking sometimes to individual bloggers. And I think we'll be seeing less and less anonymity, unfortunately, online because of fears of cybercrime and cyber terror. And there will be more and more effort to push us towards disclosing real names, providing our ID numbers when we post a comment, things like that.
Evgeny, thank you very much indeed.
Sure, thanks for talking.
Podcasts by Demos.